Welcome, everybody, to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today, we're going to be talking to Katie Halper. There's a bunch of interesting developments, particularly when it comes to Hollywood and their response to a speech by, what was the gentleman's name?
Jonathan Glazer.
Yeah, he gave, like, the most obvious speech of all time about injustice and the Middle East, and there was a massive meltdown over it, so we'll talk to her about that, a bunch of other updates on Israel and Gaza. But before we get to that, we have quite a few things to discuss real quick. So you and I actually watched yesterday, and we didn't finish it, full disclosure.
We're halfway through,
two of four episodes. Mm-hmm. Quiet on Set. I'm always going to add the. I can't help but add the. Quiet on Set is a documentary. We watched it on Max, but I think Paramount was the one who's posting it or whatever. It's about Nickelodeon, which, by the way, that's 100% my childhood. Like, I was Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network to the max. Like, I would sit there, watch it all day, right? In my opinion, some of the greatest shows of all time. Kenan and Kel, you're not going to top Kenan and Kel. Kenan and Kel is the greatest show anyway. So it's about all that and the Amanda Show and this whole, basically the idea behind Nickelodeon, and I didn't know this until watching this, is that they were trying to create like the Hollywood for kids. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting concept. And they had like the Kids' Choice Awards, which is kind of like the Oscars, but for the kids shows, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I didn't notice it at the time, but that's clearly what it was. But this documentary, man, holy cow, it just blew the roof off of the whole thing and just showed how basically a magnet for child predators, if we're being honest, when it comes to, because who's going to work at a place where it's like all these kids who are 8 years old, 12 years old, and like they're doing a sketch comedy show, and you need all these people. Some people's job is literally to usher the kids around behind the scenes when they're not with their parents. And they really highlighted the guy who created it, all that, by the name of Dan Schneider. He was the worst. And they're really exposing that there was a lot of, I mean, they showed it, Crystal. They had a lot of sexual innuendo stuff.
Yeah.
And some of the jokes for the kids.
Right.
And I think Dan Schneider got off on getting that by the audience. You know what I mean? And
getting away with it.
Getting away with it. And then, you know, you learn in the documentary, there were at least two proven, documented, went-to-prison-level pedophiles who were working behind the scenes on that show. And listening,
directly preying on the kids that were involved.
Exactly.
In the production.
Listening to, you know, the people who were the child stars talk about their experience. Woo! Anyway, childhood destroyed.
Yeah.
My childhood ripped apart now.
We didn't have cable for a long time, and I think since I'm a little older, I didn't watch a lot of these shows. I didn't have quite the, like, visceral connection to this that you did. But the conditions that they created, I mean, in retrospect, it makes all the sense in the world. Because you create this kid industrial complex. You know, you put these hard-charging Hollywood executives in charge of it, who don't really care about the well-being of these kids. They care about ratings in their careers and Hollywood stardom and whatever. And then you have basically this power dynamic where, because Dan Schneider, they really do pin a lot of the atmosphere, and I know this word, like, toxic work environment gets thrown around a lot, but that's really what he created there. He created this atmosphere and this power dynamic where everybody from the writers, the producers, the staffers that are involved to the kids and the kids' parents No, they can't complain about any aspect of it, or they won't get a part, they won't get their sketch in the show, they'll be let go, all of their hopes and dreams will be gone. And so that's where the, you know, Quiet on Set, that's where the title comes from, is because you had this, like, cone of silence where people would be coerced into doing things they were really, kids coerced into doing things they really were not comfortable with.
They had a kid version of Fear Factor, to your point.
Yeah, that they hated, or, you know, these young boys who were, like, you know, prepubescent or just going through puberty, and they're putting them in leotards that are tight and reveal everything they're super uncomfortable with, and it's, like, scarring to them, but they know they can't say anything. And one of the moms actually does speak out about a few things, and lo and behold, next season, her son is not picked up and re-upped. But, you know, to your point about the atmosphere here and what it attracted, you had two specific individuals they've identified so far in the documentary who were convicted, like, serial pedophiles who were preying on these kids. And, you know, very little was said about it at the time. The kids, when one of them was arrested by the cops, they had all the kids sit down in a meeting, and the parents are there. They make the parents leave. And then they say to the kids, with everybody there, again, you know, you can imagine your kid, whatever. They ask them, did this guy do anything to you guys? And there's just silence. Why do you remove the parents for that? You would want the parents there for that conversation. So the whole thing is just, I know I'm doing some spoilers here, but to your point about also the sexual innuendos that were in these shows, one of the guys who ends up being a pedo, his role in all that was to be quote-unquote pickle boy, and they had this recurring gag of, like, people eating these pickles in this very, like, sexual manner.
They had
just randomly, like, for no reason. What was the joke? No one knew what the joke was. It just was weird and bizarre, and it was because he loved sneaking these things in and getting it by.
They had Ariana Grande rolling around on a bed, pouring a bottle of water on her. The number of, like, phallic things they did and the number of bits that, like, simulated cum shots.
Yes.
It looked like they showed, like, five or six of them.
Right.
It's like, how many times are you going to go back to this well and do this creepy-ass shit with these children? And then Amanda Bynes, who was one of the biggest stars from all that and went on to create the Amanda Show. Everybody knows she was a giant child star.
Right.
She was Dan Schneider's favorite. And they were, like, really close. Now, that's problematic to begin with, right?
Right.
But now you look at Amanda Bynes and you're like, Jesus, what the fuck else happened? Right? Like, what happened? Because now she's, I mean, she's falling apart. 1,000 Ways to Sunday.
Yeah.
And they don't make any specific pedo allegations against Dan Schneider specifically, but there are just hints of a very inappropriate, you know, relationship with Amanda and with a bunch of the kids. There's one scene where they're both in a hot tub.
They're in a hot tub together. She's in a bathing suit.
He's
they're
fully
very touchy.
Dressed. They're very, yeah, they're very, it's very weird. To your point, the hierarchy at the place, it was a very rigid hierarchy. And by the way, as an outsider watching the show growing up, Dan was on air for a bunch of the skits.
Right.
And he just gave up. I had no idea he was even a producer. I had no idea he was the head guy. Or he played the role of, like, the goofy, affable, dumb fat guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what he played. But behind the scenes, he was apparently like a dictator. They said that early on he would be
jovial. He was more of that actual character.
Welcoming,
yeah.
And whatever. But then over time, it got darker and darker and darker.
And it wasn't just the kids who were really taken advantage of and preyed on. First of all, it's very male-dominated work environment. Now, you might think with, you know, kids and Amanda being this sort of, like, groundbreaking female child star who's there for her, you know, comic ability and whatever, that you'd have a lot of women in the writer's room, women involved in the production. It was very male-dominated. One of the women that they did have on for a period of time before they fired her as a writer, he bullied and pressured her into simulating being sodomized in a high school during
a meeting.
Team meeting. Just in completely insane stuff. But that's what he liked. He liked to force people to be humiliated. He liked to get these jokes through and pretend like, oh, I had no idea that that could be taken in a sexual way. There was a character that they named Penelope Taint. And the writers talked about, like, him saying explicitly, no, just say, oh, like, something's tainted. Of course it has not. How could you think that it would have anything to do with, like, with this body part? Of course not. Of course it would never be that. And this is this recurring character. So very, very disturbing. And no, you know, really no guardrails. And everyone involved under pressure of, like, you're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your paycheck. You're never going to work in this town again if you say anything about what's going on here.
They need, watching it, they need new laws, and they need to enforce those laws when it comes to this sort of child star stuff. Because, honestly, they should never be away from their parents.
Yes.
Or a guardian that's, a real guardian. Because, you know, the second that happens, all hell breaks loose. And the point I made to you last night is, like, who is going to be attracted to a position of working on a show like that as an adult? The writers are one thing. I think there could, you know, if you want to do comedy, you're trying to break into Hollywood, this is an opportunity. That's what happened with some of those writers who were totally fine. But, you know, the guy who had the job of ushering the kids around behind the scenes when the parents weren't around, basically being like a stand-in guardian for them, like, who's going to be attracted to get that sort of position in the first place? A fucking predator, right? First-hand access one-on-one with kids.
Right.
The first people who are going to sign up for that who are male are going to be predators, right? And so you need to find a way to make sure that doesn't happen. I don't know what you have to do to the child labor laws. Either parents got to be around all the freaking time.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and that was the other thing, as they said, they were violating child labor law left and right. Like, you know, they...
Oh, yeah. Oh, you guys got to work an extra 3 hours.
The hours
okay.
that they had to
yeah.
work, it mm-hmm. was like, oh, you can stay an extra hour. And one of the now adults who was a child star was like, oh, you know, you'd look at mom and be like, oh, I guess we're violating labor law again. Here we go. Like, what else are we going to do? You know, you said they really were working to recreate this, like, Hollywood for kids, and they really did.
You're not kidding.
All the aspects of it.
You're not
kidding. All the worst aspects of it, they totally recreated.
We're going to probably watch the rest of it tonight. It's a four-part documentary. We watched the first two. We're going to watch the next two. You guys should definitely check it out. It's on Max. Highly recommended. Disturbing. And if you're a Nickelodeon kid, look out, because you'll never look at it the same. Yeah. And that's depressing.
Yeah.
So now we got an interesting development on the general election front. There's now been a slate of polls that have come out that show Biden is leading again. So do you have the numbers in front of you?
I do.
You
want to
walk through
yeah.
that?
So what's noteworthy to me is not even so much Biden leading, but that in this series of recent polls, there's been a positive shift in his direction since January or February. These are all national polls, not battleground polls. But you've got Emerson that went from +1 Trump to +2 Biden. You've got, what do you say, TIPP, whatever, +2 Trump to +2 Biden. Ipsos tied to +2 Biden. KFF +4 to +4 Trump to +3 Biden. Civics tied to +1 Biden. And FAU, that's Florida Atlantic University, +4 Trump to +2 Biden. That last one was a likely voter screen versus all registered voters. All the rest of them were registered voters. But, you know, it appears like there may be a little bit of a trend in the making of Biden picking up a little bit of ground. You also had this week, Kyle, the primaries, which surprisingly, even though Nikki Haley is out of the race, she still got like significant amount of the vote, like 18% roughly in a couple of states this week, which I think you also have to take as a bit of a warning sign for Trump that someone would go out even after Nikki Haley's out of the race and Trump is the official presumptive nominee and still be like, nah, fuck this dude, I'm going to vote against for somebody else, I think is also, you know, something to take note of.
So some of them are mail-in votes, which
yeah,
were mailed
true.
Back
mm-hmm.
when she was running, but
yeah.
some of them also aren't. And to make the apples-to-apples comparison, on the Biden side, now granted, he had a primary, it was a much less competitive primary, and then there were some states that were trying to make it so there was no primary at all. Like, you guys know all the backstory, but Biden is kind of consistently getting around that 90% number when it comes to these races.
Mm-hmm.
To your point, yeah, with Nikki Haley dropping out, there are some states she got, Trump only got 75%, 78%, 82%, and people are looking at this like, that really is not a good sign for the general election for him, because as much as he has a base that loves him and adores him and would never leave him, there's also now a decent number of Republicans who are like, I'm never going to vote for him. You
yeah.
know, whether they were Trump voters in the past or not, largely irrelevant. There's a good chunk that are just like, I'm not going to vote for him. Now, I'm going to ask you in a second why you think it is that Biden got this bump.
Yeah.
But here are the theories that I have. So one of them that I saw on Twitter, which I thought was a decent point, I don't think that the standard economic indicators are the best way to determine the health of the economy
sure.
and the health of the American people. I don't believe that. But certainly mainstream media pushes out that idea under both Republicans and Democrats that the standard economic indicators are the way to go. Well, we have had very low unemployment for a while now, mm-hmm. and we have had the market performing well.
Yeah.
And somebody said on Twitter that their theory was like, it lags a couple quarters before those good numbers will be reflected in the polling.
Yeah.
And while I don't think those indicators are the creme de la creme, at the same time, I do think that's kind of a fair point, because Biden's approval rating was so low that it's like, with an unemployment rate like this and the market doing as well as it is, maybe he should be at 40%, 43%. But the fact he was all the way down at 33%, it did seem a little anomalous. Like,
yeah.
Like, and you could pin that off to the fact that he's so old that he wasn't getting credit for those things, et cetera. But so that's one theory as to why he had this little bounce back. And by the way, when I say little, I do mean little. Most of these polls where he's leading is 2 points, 1 point. There was one Ipsos poll that just came out that had him with a 5-point lead. That's the biggest poll I've seen.
Yeah.
Biggest
there
lead
was another
for him I've seen.
Selzer poll that came out that
and
had
Trump
him.
+7.
Yeah.
So basically we're at the point now where it's like flip a freaking coin. That's
yeah.
where we are. But that's one theory as to why, you know, he got this bump. The other one, of course, is just the State of the Union speech being a little more visible.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to hold it together better than most people thought. And so that could lead to a bump. And then the third thing is, you know, Trump in the news all the time now, it seems like it revolves around his crimes, whether it's the, you know, the various civil cases, the $83.3 million defamation thing with E. Jean Carroll, now the $454 million, $464 million, whatever it is, fraud case in New York, business fraud, insurance fraud, tax fraud, can't secure a bond for that. They may seize his properties. So now with all the headlines, it's like either him at a rally saying crazy shit.
Yeah.
Or it's criminal, 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 criminal. Here's how he's a criminal. After a while, people, like, you know, the laws of political reality apply less to Trump than to most, but they still apply to some extent.
Yeah.
Right? So that could be it. What's your theory as to why Biden's...
Those are my three theories as well. Those are...
Nice.
I mean, it could be a combination of all of them. I'm also not 100% convinced there is even a Biden bump because some of the polling is a little conflicting. If you look at the Real Clear Politics average, it hasn't really changed. Trump overall,
they
in terms of
the
average...
a lot of the pro-Biden polls yet.
Is roughly 2% in favor of Trump. So I'm not even 100% convinced there is a trend here, but if there is, those are exactly the things that I would potentially attribute it to. You know, on the economic front, it's not just unemployment's low and the stock market is up. There's also consumer sentiment has improved significantly, and you have had, for a while now, wages increasing and outpacing inflation. So, again, I echo your sentiments that that does not mean all is well with the American consumer or with Americans and the economy in general. But there are some things that, you know, have improved. And it does make sense to me there could be a lag there in terms of giving Biden credit. So that's not a crazy idea to me. Certainly, I'm sure the Biden people are loving this, are, you know, holding on to it for all it's worth. But I can tell you one thing that is not helping him, and that is the continued support of a genocide in Gaza. So considerable weight on his prospects.
The other thing to keep in mind, too, is while in the Real Clear Politics average, like you said, Trump is plus two in that. That is going to come down once they include some of the newer polls. So we'll be closer to dead even Stevens. Mm-hmm. But something to keep in mind is that's not really going to be the general election race. The general election race is going to have Jill Stein on most of the ballots. They're probably going to have a Libertarian. And then it's an open question as to how many ballots RFK will get on, mm-hmm. Cornel West will get on. RFK will probably get on more ballots than Cornel West.
Yeah.
He's already gotten on like three or four or something like that. So, just when you look at it, Biden, Trump, and RFK, you go from Trump plus two to Trump plus 4.3.
That's a good point.
So it's like, you know, it is way, way, way too close for comfort. But as we always point out when discussing this, it really is a fucking race to the bottom with this stuff.
Absolutely.
It's like the absolute insane dictatorial criminal or the man who's half asleep who's funding a genocide and also cut out those pandemic social safety net programs,
yeah,
which were
right.
a lifeline to a tremendous number of people. So I'm not doing a full false equivalence here and saying they're equal. They're definitely not equal. But at the same time, I think the sense everybody's getting, the sense normies are having is like, who do I hate the least? That's who I'll vote for.
Yeah. No, that is the race. That's it right there. Whoever wins, the majority of the people who hate both of them will be the next president.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about is because that is such a, your guy you love, Stephen A. Smith, he was saying something about how he's disgusted with, you know, these two and like, okay, we really not do any better. I mean, this is such a common sentiment. You can almost talk to anyone, no matter their political ideology, and find a lot of common ground being like, what are we doing here? It's the race no one wants, and yet somehow we ended up with exactly the race that Americans dread the most. So in any case, we'll see if the trends continue and what to attribute them to. And then the last thing that I'll add to this in terms of the numbers, there's some really interesting, if you dig into some of these polls, data points around people who typically don't vote but who are saying they're going to vote in this time around versus people who routinely vote. Those people who were like 2022 voters and they were 2020 voters and they show up every time, they tend to favor Joe Biden. Trump has a huge lead. The last one I saw was like 23 points among people who haven't voted before. So that's going to be another big determining factor of like, you know, are Democrats able to succeed because the most reliable voters have now shifted over into being largely in the Democratic camp versus Republicans relying on these infrequent voters. That's kind of their cope about why they're doing so poorly in the special elections, but it's going to be different in a presidential election because they say, oh, well, those people will turn up when it's a presidential year. But that's the other big question mark is, like, who even should these pollsters be talking to? What is the universe that's actually going to turn out?
It's such a crapshoot. It's such a crapshoot.
It really is.
On the Democratic side, you got uncommitted. You got those devastatingly bad polls with young people.
And in battleground states, the numbers still look really bad.
So all that is legit. But what's also legit is there is a real large chunk of conservative Republicans and independents who lean right who are just like, I'm not gonna fucking vote for Trump. I'm not doing it.
Yeah. So and it's Trump has really leaned into some very insane, like, actual Nazi, like, poisoning the blood of America about immigrants rhetoric that plays great in a Republican primary.
Terrible in a general.
But terrible in a
terrible
general.
Terrible in a general.
And also, that is the headline along with the criminal charges. And you're seeing, like, week after week, this just absolute insanity coming from him. It is a real reminder of, like, oh, yeah, that's what it was like when he was president.
And also the 2020 election denialism stuff. He's still going full speed on
that. Yes, he is.
And there is no doubt that was a huge factor in the Republicans massively underperforming in the midterms.
Yeah.
55% of their candidates that they were running were election deniers. And they did the worst. And this is the guy. He's the head of the election denying thing. And it's like, I'm sure there's plenty of conservatives looking at that. Like, shut the fuck up. Just shut up.
And
can you not talk about that? Or abortion, please?
And they're also nominating, like, a bunch of psychos. And
you saw the North Carolina guy is a total psycho, literal Holocaust denier type.
Yeah.
And then who was the other? Oh, the Ohio guy.
Now, this one is kind of a, okay, so there's the thing about, I don't remember the detail. He set up the account.
Let the man live.
They say it was an intern.
He wants to suck a dick every now and then,
but
right?
But he also seemed to come out in favor of a national abortion ban with no exceptions, which may even be really the bigger problem for him. It was the Democrats put millions behind boosting this guy, by the way, in the primary. I don't know if you know that. Chuck Schumer's PAC spent like $2.9 million or something.
They always do this, yeah.
So they really feel good about their prospects versus him. He has taken he's this self-made businessman. He's taken these sort of like more populist positions. So it's not entirely clear to me they made the right play there, but I just think when you are nominating these candidates who are far out of the mainstream, it's a problem not just for those candidates, but it taints the entire Republican Party as a bunch of insane fringe wackos.
I think in the aggregate, this actually is a smart move from the Democrats, but, and this is a big but, every now and then one of those fuckers is going to win, right? You're not going to win every one against them. But, you know, they beat Carrie Lake. They beat Herschel Walker. They beat Doug Mastriano. Like, you can go down the list of, like, psycho, 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 loss, loss, loss. But every now and then, there's going to be one.
And then you're like, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, she is a member of Congress.
Lauren Boebert, right? Like, and this guy, to your point, you know, classic Republican says anti-gay stuff, and they found out that an email tied to him from, like, 2009 or something was on, like, adult gay friend finder.
When he said something like looking for young guys for a good time or something like that.
The second these anti-gay conservatives think nobody's looking, they're like, oh. It is a law of nature.
It really
nature.
Is like clockwork.
It's a
incredible.
Law of nature.
Now, this guy, apparently he has made a big, like, Trump-era pivot. So he, in 2016, sort of like J.D. Vance, he was very against Trump, and he said, you know, he's abhorrent or whatever he said about him then. And now that he sees the writing on the wall, he's gone full MAGA, like saying whatever he needs to say to the Republican base in order to get elected. So anyway,
Trump is
on top of everything, he also apparently doesn't really believe anything.
Trump is such a sucker. You can say 99 things that are like viciously critical of him. And then the second you make that pivot and you're like, actually, I changed my mind. I think he's awesome. He's like, welcome to MAGA.
Yeah.
You're on my side. We love you.
He
amazing
also
person.
Bowed out of the Senate race last time around to try to boost J.D. Vance. So there was also a bit of like, oh, well, it's his turn because he did
the
thing
we
wanted him to last time. He backed that. He took the anti-abortion side of that ballot initiative that they did in the state of Ohio, which I think also will be a problem for
him. That's going to be a huge problem. And he's running against Sherrod Brown.
Wildly unpopular.
And Sherrod Brown.
Sherrod's a great politician.
He's very solid. I mean, look, he's been representing Ohio, which is now legit a red state.
Mm-hmm.
He's been repping Ohio as a Democrat for a really long time. So it's sort of like the Manchin effect in West Virginia, where he usually pulls it off, and you're like, how the fuck did this guy win again?
Yeah.
As a Democrat in West Virginia, that's Sherrod Brown in Ohio. Yeah. So this guy's got an uphill battle. He should probably go suck some more dicks.
He might be happier in the long run.
I definitely
think
he would
be. In the short and the long run.
All right. On the note of sucking dicks, let's move on.
How are you going to make this turn? Are you going to throw that ball to me?
Yeah, well... If I stop talking now, then you could just announce the
Okay, so we have a wonderful guest to coming up, Katie Halper, who's a great friend of the show, co-host of Useful Idiots, and also host of The Katie Halper Show. And we had a bunch of topics we wanted to get to with her, so let's go ahead and do that. Katie, so great to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Of course. So we wanted to get your thoughts, first of all, before we get into even the reaction and the backlash and whatever, to Jonathan Glazer's comments in his Oscar acceptance award-winning speech from Zone of Interest. What did you make of what he had to say about how he objected to his Jewishness being weaponized effectively to justify things that were unjustifiable?
I thought his statements were great. I also thought the movie was really great, and I recommend that everyone see it. I think that the fact that critics had to lie about what he had said, so as you pointed out, he basically said, we stand here as men who refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation. And then, of course, people immediately pretended that he had said that they refuted their Jewishness, which is not at all what he said. He was saying that he was tired or didn't want his Jewishness and the history of the Holocaust to be weaponized to justify another genocide. And people at first had to smear him by lying. And then they were, once they kind of couldn't lie about what he had said anymore, then they pretended that what he said on its face and in reality was offensive. And of course, it wasn't offensive. I mean, the takeaway of never again is not never again to Jews. It's never again to anyone else. And this letter, I mean, people wrote that 1,000 Hollywood creatives. It's really pathetic. It's like probably the best PR for Jonathan Glazer possible when you have a group of Hollywood creatives, the most famous of whom is Deborah Messing. That's a pretty low bar. I mean, if I were Jonathan Glazer, I would like brag about being smeared by someone as stupid and irrelevant as Deborah Messing. But they were upset that he even kind of, they said that they refuted their Jewishness being hijacked, basically.
I have the quote.
Okay,
they say, refute our Jewishness being hijacked for the purpose of drawing a moral equivalence between a Nazi regime that sought to exterminate a race of people and an Israeli nation that seeks to avert its own extermination.
Yeah, and they really give away the game because that's one thing. I mean, there are people who, and we can get into this in a second, there are people who have a problem with comparing anything to the Holocaust. Now, we'll get into that in a second. But it's one thing to say the Holocaust was very unique and specific, and we shouldn't trivialize it by comparing it to other things. Now, they give away the game, though, by saying in this letter that Israel isn't targeting civilians. So whatever potential legitimacy they have in their statement goes right away. I mean, they've totally disqualified themselves as lying ideologues who are either in denial and incredibly stupid, which probably is the case for Deborah Messing, or are just lying, which it could also be the case for Deborah Messing, but she's actually someone who I think maybe doesn't really understand anything that's going on, quite frankly.
Here's the other thing is even this is not honest about what he said. He did not actually compare.
Right.
Now, I think those comparisons, the ideology behind the Holocaust and what's being done to Palestinians, I think there is a comparison to be drawn there. But that's not even what he did. He said, don't weaponize that history to justify what's happening here. He didn't actually equate the two. So even in this statement, it's like a more sophisticated gaslighting than just cutting the quote out of context as they initially did. But it's still dishonest with regard to what he actually said.
It's a more nuanced lie. So props to them for improving their PR. But you know what you're saying is incredibly important because the irony is, of course, that the same people who say don't compare the Holocaust to what's happening now, you're trivializing it, don't cheapen it. They cheapen the Holocaust every single day that they use that as an excuse to kill people. So as you're saying, we don't even have to make the comparison. How about you just stop weaponizing this? Like when you had the UN ambassador show up at the UN wearing the yellow Star of David, the thing that Jewish people were forced to wear. I mean, how dare you? How dare you compare yourselves to the people who were exterminated by Nazis? I mean, that is so disgusting. And again, I happen to think that also there is the takeaway of the Holocaust should be we should never look away again while people are being genocided. Now, I know some people don't even agree it's genocide. Fine, I do think it's genocide. I think the experts have agreed it's genocide. But even if you don't think it's genocide, how about just never looking away as people are cleansed or people are killed for no crime other than being what they are? We all know that this is not a war on Hamas. I mean, every time I hear someone say the Israel-Hamas war, I'm like, it's the game. Are you dumb or disingenuous? This is an incredibly civilian-focused war. They target civilians. I mean, we know this. News just broke that they bombed an orphanage. There's literally no line that they won't cross. And a lot of people keep saying, oh, it's not like what the Nazis did. Fine, you don't have to compare it to what the Nazis did. But we should also bear in mind that there was not social media around when the Nazis were doing what they were doing. We don't know what they would have done to cater to a kind of international audience. Now, what's scary is that Israel does what it's doing and streams it, which shows like they seem to not care about the social media. Or what scares me is that they probably would be doing even worse things if there weren't social media. I mean, I don't know if they wouldn't be doing more methodical extermination. They are being methodical. I guess I should say, I don't know if they wouldn't be doing more industrialized extermination if they didn't have cameras all over.
So let me ask you this, and Crystal, I'm curious your thoughts too. How much of the backlash over this is bad faith? Because I remember I saw Meghan McCain was one of the first people I saw comment on this. And she was under the impression that he said, we refute our Jewishness. Stop the sentence there. Don't read the rest of it, right? And I got the sense that there's some of it where it's just like they just didn't see the full quote or care about the full. It was enough of them to go out there and morally grandstand and virtue signal about how you're an anti-Semite.
And then they didn't want to backtrack because they felt embarrassed by that.
So
once it was clear.
So how much of it is bad faith versus laziness, stupidity? Let me just react immediately type stuff. What do you think, Katie? And then I want to know your thoughts too, Krista.
Well, I mean, someone like Batya Unger-Sargon, right, who is the first person who put the tweet out that misrepresented what he said, that's obviously bad faith. She chose to put a period after "we refute our Jewishness," period, which totally changes what they're saying. I think some people really were duped by it. But I think once you get to the letter writers, these creatives topped by Deborah Messing, it becomes, as Crystal said, it is bad faith in that they're claiming that he's making a false equivalence. But what they don't want is they just don't want anyone, as you can see, they say in the letter that they're not targeting civilians. So they don't want anyone criticizing Israel on grounds that you not only can criticize them for, but have to criticize them for. I don't know how you can not criticize an army, a nation that is targeting civilians. And, I mean, there's story after story. Like, what needs to happen before people stop trying to pretend they don't target civilians? They target journalists. They have an all-out war on journalists. They know where these people live. They have the civilian registries. They know where their families are. These aren't just journalists getting killed in the line of fire while they're out reporting, which they do also. And in fact, there's that horrific story about a journalist who was shot and is the IDF wouldn't let medics get to him. He bled out over the course of hours. He was an Al Jazeera journalist.
That's right.
He bled out over the course of hours. And as paramedics were trying to get to him, they shot the paramedics.
Jesus.
I mean, and then there's that story of him, that little girl who was in a car who they killed as her family was already dead. You hear this haunting audio recordings of her, asking to be rescued. And what does Israel do? They kill her. This is the most moral army in the world. So what we're having is that the letter does the exact thing that Glaser is objecting to, which is it weaponizes anti-Semitism and it tries to use that as a shield to defend everything that Israel does. And then when you criticize Israel, you're being an anti-Semite. It's a little bit uncomfortable when the guy doing it, as Glazer is Jewish. Then you have to go to like the self-loathing criticism. But I think these people are an embarrassment. Then you had a CNN op-ed that was really embarrassing. That was so embarrassing. This guy, and I'm kind of embarrassed, especially personally, because I went to Wesleyan and this guy is now a Wesleyan professor. But he actually wrote a review and he said, he complained that there were no Jews in the film. He made a similar, what'd you say?
In Zone of Interest, Glazer's film.
In Zone of Interest, yes, yeah. In Glazer's film. He said that there were no Jews in the film. He also admitted to not getting something that's really obvious. This is a spoiler alert, but there's a scene because the reason we didn't get into this yet, but the reason this movie is so powerful and has so many parallels with today is because it's about an Auschwitz commandant whose family lives this idyllic life in a beautiful villa with a beautiful garden. They deal with very mundane things in the movie. Nothing really happens except he's dealing with a promotion and he's supposed to move and his wife doesn't want to move. And it shows the inhumanity and depravity in a very mundane way, which is actually very powerful. But, and we can talk about that in a second, but the reason this film is such a parallel to today is because you have these people in real life and in the film living next to Auschwitz and acting as if life is normal and carrying on with their daily routines while on the other side of this wall, which serves as their garden wall, on the other side of this wall, you have people being exterminated. And the father and husband figure in this film, and it's based on Rudolf Höss, is in charge of, cremating people, basically, you know, disposing of bodies. And then he's supposed to be in charge of another operation in Hungary. And, you know, the wife really likes her garden and you see people, the wife is looking at what she got from the Holocaust victims, obviously, because she gets like a fur coat, she gets these chocolates, she gets a lipstick. And there are no Jews physically in the film, but something that's really powerful about the film is and it won awards for its sound, is the sound, because you hear screams and gunshots and dogs in the background, which again symbolizes how these people were okay having all of this in the background. You also see the smokestack. You see the smoke, which is people's remains being burned. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in the foreground. That's in the background, I should say. So you have this beautiful bucolic, idyllic scenes, and in the background are the bodies, not physical bodies, but the remains of the bodies being burned, and you see that. And there's this scene where they're in a river, the father and his kids, and again, it's very beautiful, and they see human remains in this river. And it's very obvious that that's what it is, because there's like a jawbone, and it's obvious because they then go home and scrub the kids in a bath, like because it's so gross. And this guy, this brilliant guy at Wesleyan University who wrote the CNN review said, it was tedious and it was confusing. I didn't even know that had happened, except I had heard someone, but you couldn't tell that's what happened. Again, just giving away the game in this instance that he has no idea what he's talking about. Right. And the fact that there are no Jews on screen is a very intentional decision. And it's to show that this is what life was like if you were just living next to Auschwitz. And it was easy to look the other way. I mean, you could see, you couldn't avoid the smoke and the sound, but it was easy to not see the actual Jewish prisoners, concentration camp inmates. And likewise, it's easy to live in Israel and not see the people in Gaza, right. This open-air concentration camp. I mean, that's the real parallel there.
It's the banality of evil. It's that old saying, the banality of evil. And it's, I remember in college, we read this book called Ordinary Men. Which is, it's the same idea. It's like, we're going to take you into what it was like to be just a rank and file Nazi somewhere down the line.
Just doing my job.
Just doing my job. You know, I work security at the concentration camp or whatever. And it gets into exactly how it just becomes normalized. Everything becomes normalized. Everything becomes standard operating procedure. Everything becomes the status quo. And I remember arguing in the class with the professor and saying, like, this is evil. Like, what they're doing is evil. And what young Kyle didn't understand is that it's like, yes, it is evil. That's the point, is that it's super evil. But it's the human psychology behind it that makes people sort of wash the evilness from it. Right?
They just go like, along like sheep. I mean, I thought Naomi Klein wrote, I haven't seen Zone of Interest, by the way, but Naomi Klein wrote her own sort of review and connecting it to his comments in that whole Oscar ceremony. And she was saying, you know, it was really dissonant because right after he says this, they go into this whole like goofy Barbenheimer bit.
Right.
But then she, upon further reflection, she was like, you know, it actually in a way made exactly the point that he was trying to make and that the film was trying to make about how this evil can be going on. And if you've got your walls properly erected, it's just in the background. Right. You don't even pay attention to it. She said some of the patterns, the wall, the ghetto, the mass killing, the repeatedly stated eliminationist intent, the mass starvation, the pillaging, the joyful dehumanization, and the deliberate humiliation are repeating. So too are the ways that genocide becomes ambient. The way those of us a little further away from the walls can block the images and tune out the cries and just carry on. That's why the Academy made Glazer's point for him when it hard cut to Barbenheimer, itself a trivialization of mass slaughter, without missing a beat. Atrocity is once again becoming ambient. One might see the entire Oscar spectacle as a kind of live action extension of the Zone of Interest, a sort of denialism on ice.
Mm. Yeah, it's very well put. And, you know, speaking of the ambience of it and the joyfulness of it, something that we don't see in Zone of Interest, and something I think that the banality of evil, you know, Arendt's concept of banality of evil speaks to, is the kind of lack of joyfulness that went into these killings. In other words, it wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't fueled by glee necessarily. Or it didn't lead to glee. I mean, there were of course pogroms where there was kind of spontaneous violence. But what made the Holocaust so unique in some ways was the industrialization of it, right? The industrialized nature of it and how you could be so distant from it. But in the case of Israel, we actually see a real gleeful enjoyment of these humiliations, right? Like we see the delight in humiliating people, the delight in blowing things up, the giggling, the celebrating. And that is not even the banality of evil. That's kind of the like the entertainment of evil, yeah. Or celebration of evil. Yeah.
Yeah. I was struck by, I mean, of course, it's been this big conversation about these IDF soldiers who have been TikToking their war crimes.
Destroying, you know, Palestinian shops in the West Bank.
And, like, you know, posing with plundered lingerie. And right. I mean, just, you know, things that you're like, I love the response that's like, why would you post this? Instead of, why would you do this and think that this is okay? But, you know, it really clicked for me when they had that big ethnic cleansing conference in, I believe it was in Tel Aviv, where you had a bunch of Israelis got together and they're like, here's our plans for Gaza. Here's how we're going to resettle it. Here's how we're going to push the Palestinians out. Here's what we're going to do. And in Haaretz's write-up of that conference, which, by the way, I think more than a dozen like government ministers and Likud party members and powerful officials, et cetera, attended. So this wasn't just like some fringe gathering. This was very much the mainstream power center in Israel. The biggest applause came for exactly that content. And so then it clicked for me that it's not a bug that they're putting these things down. Oh, they're just undisciplined and whatever. And if they crack down, like if they really understood, they would crack down and they wouldn't put these things out. No, this is intentionally allowed, encouraged, et cetera, for domestic consumption, because they aren't going to be able to achieve their always fanciful purported war aims of hunting for Hamas and destroying Hamas. So what substitutes for that is just complete annihilation. It is complete humiliation. It's complete destruction. It's, you know, those TikToks. That's what substitutes for victory, since the supposed stated war aims are never going to be achieved.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's not a bug. It's a feature.
Yes, that's
it's
exactly
built
right.
into it. Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly
another thing
right.
I just wanted to take a moment to point out is there is this very interesting thing that is shown in the film. There's a part where there's you hear some Yiddish. And of course, all the people who say that there aren't Jews in the film skip over this. They probably didn't notice it. They didn't pay attention. But it's a very important and moving story. It's actually based, it's actual it's actual audio that's taken from someone named Joseph Wolf. And he had this Yiddish song, Sunbeams, and it was composed at Auschwitz. And he became kind of a historian. Also, he became committed to documenting Germany's crimes. And you hear this being sung over a Polish girl who, in the movie, there's this kind of hopeful character. There's this Polish girl who leaves apples for the prisoners. And you hear him saying, sunbeams, radiant and warm, human bodies, young and old, and who are imprisoned here, our hearts are yet not cold. And that's actual testimony from someone who was in Auschwitz, which is important. Wow. Yeah. It's fascinating. He wound up killing himself, this person, by the way, Joseph Wolf, because, and before he jumped out of a window in Berlin, he had written to his son saying how he lamented how he felt like nothing he was doing and writing down was making a difference. And it's kind of, I mean, it's poignant that his words wind up in, you know, something, a film that Steven Spielberg calls one of the most important Holocaust films. So,
Wow.
I want to get to the Horetz piece written by playwright and screenwriter Tony Kushner. Did you see this, Crystal?
Yeah, so actually we have some of this audio. So I'm not a big, I don't know a lot of playwrights, but apparently Tony Kushner is basically like the most famous American playwright.
Yeah.
Lincoln, collaborated with Spielberg, et cetera.
On Munich, and importantly enough, on Munich, and wrote this really important play, Angels in America, about the HIV/AIDS crisis. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So celebrated playwright. He spoke with Horetz about Jonathan Glazer, about his comments. And he also made a comment that's not included in this audio snippet I'm about to play, but saying, you know, what's happening in Gaza sure looks like ethnic cleansing to me. Let's take a listen to a bit of what he had to say.
The idea that, you know, in the blowback after Jonathan Glazer's, you know, really sort of unimpeachable, irrefutable statement at the Oscars.
You identified with what he said?
Of course. I mean, who doesn't? What he's saying is so simple. He's saying Jewishness, Jewish identity, Jewish history, the history of the Holocaust, the history of Jewish suffering must not be used in a campaign of, as an excuse for a project of dehumanizing or slaughtering other people. This is a misappropriation of what it means to be a Jew, what the Holocaust meant, and he rejects that. Who doesn't agree with that? What kind of person thinks that what's going on now in Gaza is acceptable? And if you find yourself saying out loud and in public, oh, it's fine with me what they're doing, because you feel that it's the only choice for you because you're a Jew, is to defend everything that Israel does, you know, shame on you.
What do you think of those comments, Katie?
I mean, I 100% agree with them. I think that, and I was very pleased to hear him say those things. I think that something, you know, a lot of times people like Tony Kushner or Jonathan Glazer will be called self-loathing Jews, or they'll say they are putting Jews at risk, you know, and Israel is making Jews safe. I think it's actually really important for Jews to speak out against what Israel is doing, not just because it's the moral thing to do, which I do think it is, but also because, for kind of self-interested reasons, I mean, we have to show the world that we don't stand with Israel, that being a Zionist or being an Israel supporter is not synonymous with being a Jew. And I've said this a lot before, but, you know, the claim that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic is actually an anti-Semitic argument in itself, because that is presenting Jews as this monolith who all support Israel, and it's presenting Israel as kind of synonymous with Jewishness or Jewry. And there are lots of anti-Zionist Jews. There are post-Zionist Jews. There are Jews who are not anti-Zionist but are critical of what Israel's doing. We're not a monolith. And I actually think it's really important, as Israel commits these crimes, you know, while waving the Star of David, while waving a flag with the Star of David, I think it's really important for Jews to speak out against this.
there were comments that were made by, you'll probably remember this, I think her name's May Golan, is that right? She's like the Israeli minister of female empowerment or something like that. And she made these comments that I've heard a lot of insane things, but for whatever reason, these particularly stuck with me. Because she was saying, I want the Palestinians, I want their children, I want their grandchildren to remember not what Israel did, what the Jews did in Gaza. And I thought that, you know, unintentionally made so powerfully the point that you are making, that in terms of keeping Jewish people safe here and around the world, like requiring them all to be associated with these atrocities being committed in front of our eyes and making that an essential component of Judaism and what it means to be a Jew, like what could be a more horrific and stoke more anti-Semitism than that?
Exactly. Yeah, Israel is very responsible for a lot of anti-Semitism. They certainly are stoking it. Israel doesn't make us safer. Israel makes Jews less safe. And they keep saying, oh, the biggest attack on Jews since the Holocaust happened on October 7th, which isn't, I don't think, a really helpful way to or accurate way to look at it. It's not, this was not about attacking Jews because they were Jewish. But where did that happen? That happened in Israel. If Israel keeps Jews so safe, then how did that happen?
It reminds me of, you made this point in a recent monologue, Black nationalism, the idea of Black nationalism. It is very understandable in the context of what happened in the U.S. throughout our history and around the world, how we had slavery, we had Jim Crow. So the idea of somebody stepping up, like a Malcolm X at the time, and saying, like, we want a nation of our own. That's what we want. And, of course, that didn't happen. But the sentiment was understandable. By the same token, Israel, certainly post-Holocaust, the sentiment is incredibly understandable that, like, hey, we want a safe area where it's basically just us. The problem with it is, as time goes by, if you're creating a government based on ethnicity, based on religion, based on a mix thereof of those two things, it is by definition exclusionary. So it's fertile grounds for that state to do the same kind of oppression to a different group down the line. So the logic leads to a horrible place. And I think that's something that people don't really reckon with when it comes to Israel. It's easy to just knee-jerk invoke the Holocaust and how vital and crucial it is to protect Jews, which is absolutely true. But you can't, in the name of that, dispossess Palestinians, Muslims, Arabs, or any other group for that matter.
I mean, it's not even down the line, right? In the case of Israel, it's immediately because they had to create a demographic majority. That's what they want to do. There were Jews in Israel. I mean, people are right that there were always Jews in Israel. They just weren't a majority at that point. And they, for the most part, lived in harmony. I mean, there was tension, but for the most part, there certainly was nothing remotely comparable to what we saw in Europe. I mean, the anti-Semitism in Europe was totally dwarfed anything that we saw in the Middle East. But right away, you had ethnic cleansing. So it wasn't even down the line. It was right away. I mean, it's one thing to build a Jewish state somewhere where there aren't people living. And one of the false logos of Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land. Now, there were lots of people there. And that's why they had to expel them or transfer them, as they called it euphemistically. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have this historian. I know that you guys saw the Unfortunate for Destiny debate between Benny Morris and Destiny on the one side and Norman Finkelstein and Mouin Rabbani on the other. The interesting thing is that Benny Morris is a historian who is very supportive of Israel. He's on the right, but he is too good of a historian to totally lie about what happened. And he documented this transference, this ethnic cleansing in his book, 1948. I mean, the documents don't lie. He just kind of is like, well, it wasn't that bad. They had to do it. But right. Anyone who's honest about it knows that it was ethnically cleansed. It was founded. You can't create a Jewish state when there are lots of people living there unless you kick those people out. Where are they going to go?
Well, and I mean, there was a lot of honesty among Zionists at the time about the project that they were engaged in. And if you listen to, you know, Daniela Weiss and other, like, settlers right now, Israelis, or even, you know, anybody on the even moderate right, quote unquote moderate right or far right in Israel, much more honest about what they want to say. I mean, it's the true. Ethnic cleansing conference, they're like, no, they need to go. Here's how we're going to resettle. These other countries need to take them. It's us versus them. The ambition is out in the open. I wanted to get your reaction too in a similar
vein. Sorry, just one more thing before is that we also have that with the early Zionists, they call themselves colonizers and colonists. They had their first Zionist bank was
office
called
of the colonization
Trust.
Or whatever.
Yeah, they had the Office of Colonization. And they even, like, Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky talk about, of course, these natives are going to resist. Natives always resist colonizers.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, listen, there's just a simple logic at play. You want to create a majority population, a Jewish population, in an area that's not majority Jewish.
Right.
How's that going to happen? You're either going to expel people, you're going to have apartheid, or you're going to have genocide. Those are your options. And of course, we've seen a mix of all three deployed in the context of this conflict. I wanted to get your reaction to some recent comments from our former president, Trump. He's weighing in on what it means to be Jewish, Katie. So you might want to take note of this. Let's take a listen to that.
Take out my pen and pencil and paper.
Why do the Democrats hate Bibi Netanyahu?
I actually think they hate Israel.
Yes.
I don't think they hate him. I think they hate Israel. And the Democrat Party hates Israel. Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel. And they should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed.
Any Jewish person who votes for Democrats hates their religion, Katie. It's that simple.
Yeah. I good to know. I'm glad to know where I stand. I like it because it's a nice callback to Biden telling black voters that they're not black if they don't vote for Biden. But this is absolutely ridiculous. It kind of reminds me of when Trump spoke at the Republican Jewish Coalition. It was kind of hilarious because he's like, I know you're not going to vote for me, but you should because I'm a good negotiator. I'm like you. I'm like you.
A lot of good negotiators in this room. A lot of good negotiators.
Great stand up. It's just ridiculous. What's scary is that we're reminded that the two front runners in the race, you know, Biden and Trump, you have a genocide enabler on the one hand and a genocide celebrator on the other. Trump said recently, you know, we have to finish it, right? These are people who are trying to suck up to Israel and to Netanyahu. Biden has kind of the PR, I guess, awareness to pretend to be critical of Netanyahu. And we saw what Schumer said the other day. But yeah, most Jews are Democrats, and there's not really anything that Donald Trump can say about that, I guess, unless he wants to lean into the self-loathing trope. But
it's actually astonishing to me how bad the instincts are in this instance, because what he's trying to do is go to the right of Biden, find the little sliver of room to the right of Biden. Mm-hmm. And the argument is like, you don't support Israel enough. You don't let them do what they want enough. You need to, you know, unleash them, let them finish the job. And it's like he has in the past, he's shown more reasonable instincts on this front with like Afghanistan when he used to say we need to get out of there, or Iraq, it was a stupid war, et cetera. But on this issue in particular, and there's more to that clip too where he goes on and he talks about how, you know, I ripped up the Iran deal. The Democrats did the Iran deal. So I'm more in favor of Israel. Look at what I did. And it's like, you absolute moron. Like, if anything, that was the thing that was making it so that Iran would not get a nuclear weapon. They were following the deal, and you ripped it up. The real criticism of Biden is he didn't get back in the deal. Mm-hmm. The real criticism of Biden is that he continued your policy, right? So it's not anti-war at all is my point.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. When this happened, when October 7th happened, Trump had this very, like, bizarre Trumpian response where he was, like, calling Netanyahu really weak.
Yep.
Because he's mad at Netanyahu because he didn't go along with him to kill Soleimani.
That's right.
Which is just like Trump's politics in a nutshell. Like, it's all so personal.
Yep.
I mean, I have a fantasy that if Trump were to get in office, wouldn't it be great if Netanyahu somehow, like, offended him personally and then Trump became an anti-Zionist?
Yes. 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 The fucked up thing is, though, they want him back. You know, that's actually, I actually think this is part of Netanyahu's calculation, where normally if Washington says, hey, man, you got to tone it down just a little bit, reel it in on the genocide, about 32%, please. We're struggling over here. Normally, I think he'd be like, okay, we can slow it up a touch. But he's going in the other direction. I think part of the calculation, he wants to do it, first of all. But second of all is, the worse I make Biden look, the better, because then we're going to get the other guy who I want more.
Yeah, well, it's a win-win for him, because unfortunately, what he's doing is very popular in Israel. He's not popular.
Exactly. It's
that's
important. But what he's doing is very popular. Right. And, you know, he's got the biggest terrorist psychos imaginable in his coalition that he wants to keep in his coalition. So he gets to have it both ways. He gets to do the genocide. That is, you know, their fondest wish and desire, apparently. And he also gets to screw over Joe Biden and his election prospects and get back the guy who will just be like, yay, genocide, instead of, I'm not sure about this genocide, but go ahead and do it anyway. So it's just wins all around for him. But, you know, Katie, one of the things I've noticed with this, like, rhetorical shift, I'm actually curious what your reaction to the Chuck Schumer Netanyahu comments were, because I think it's so convenient for liberal Zionists to say, like, oh, well, the problem is just Bibi and his right-wing government, ignoring the fact that, as I just said, well, actually, basically the entire population more or less supports what's going on. There was only 1.6% or whatever that said the IDF has gone too far. There's, you know, renewed interest in resettling Gaza, and all of these things are actually becoming increasingly popular. There is not a majority in favor of a two-state solution in Israel. So it's very convenient to be like, oh, well, it's Bibi and the right-wingers that are the sole problem. It's just a matter of a few bad apples. That lets you off the hook from dealing with these much larger and much more systemic issues.
Yeah, it's a totally it's an optics move, what Schumer's doing. I mean, he's first of all, nothing's going to happen until the war winds down, right? To the extent that he wants new elections, it's not going to happen until the war winds down. Second of all, as you said, Netanyahu's not popular, but his policies of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, they ask it in the polls is like the use of force, that's popular. Mm-hmm. So you get rid of Netanyahu, and then who comes in? Benny Gantz, who ran a campaign ad bragging about turning parts of Gaza into the Stone Age. I mean, this is the sad reality, and it's something that I think Israel supporters have to grapple with, is that it's not just Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu is incredibly corrupt, so people don't like him because of that, and they feel like he didn't keep them safe on October 7th. But it's not that they have an issue, unfortunately, with the violence being inflicted on Palestinians. Now, there are some people who have relatives who are hostages who want negotiation because they realize that the longer they're held, the more likely it is. I mean, who knows how many of the hostages Israel has killed in bombings? We know that they shot three of them. There's also a woman who says that her son was gassed in a tunnel. I don't know if you follow that story, but there's a woman whose son was a hostage. She says that he was gassed because there was an autopsy and it didn't show anything except potential poison. And then she wrote something about that on his tombstone, and then they removed the tombstone. I mean, this is, again, the most moral army in the world that takes care of its soldiers, except it kills them. Besides that, I mean, we heard this story, right? There's a report about Biden like yelling at his aides and throwing some stuff in a room because he looked at the poll numbers. And this is obviously just a way to kind of like a release valve. Like, okay, we'll throw them we'll throw them a bone. Now they're going to say, look, they're being hard on Netanyahu. Look at Schumer. The Democrats are really, you know, cracking the whip. They're criticizing Netanyahu. This is what you guys wanted, right? No, that's not what we wanted. We want a stop to the genocide. We want our government to stop arming and aiding and legitimizing what Israel's doing. And we know from Israeli sources that they couldn't do this without support of the United States.
What I'm curious about is Netanyahu in on this kabuki theater? Does he fully understand what's going on? Because the whole point is, I'm going to go out there, make it look like I have a clear break with you. Schumer, by all the articles about Biden's really angry, Biden raised his voice, Biden called him an asshole. The whole point is to paint the picture that, no, seriously, We're not with these guys. We think they're going too far. But like Netanyahu came out the other day and talked to Dana Bash on CNN, and he was like responding to Schumer and Biden and doing it forcefully and basically saying, like, could you imagine if after 9/11 people were telling George W. Bush to step down? No, you got to finish the job first. I know, right?
Honestly.
I know. But yeah. do you think he's in on the Kabuki theater, or is like are they so on a hair trigger of being offended that even the Kabuki theater makes Netanyahu genuinely be like, hey, fuck you? Which do you think?
Well,
it
even
is?
If it were Kabuki theater, he'd have to do that, right? I mean, to play the part effectively,
but do you think
have
it's
to be
sincere
saying,
or what?
I don't know.
Like, are they actually fighting, or is it like, I'm going to do this thing where I'm going to say this about you say that about me, you know what I'm saying?
See, I'm more inclined to think it's that because there was actually something that shifted my thinking on this that I just saw today, which is a report that Biden behind the scenes told Bibi, I'm not trying to push you out.
Right, it's all a show.
That's just basically a revelation.
I didn't see that report.
Like,
that's interesting.
Yeah, a revelation of like, we got to do this. Like, look at my poll numbers. Michigan, I got a problem. I got to say these things to appease these people. And you also had multiple reports of like, Kamala Harris, when Benny Gantz was here, saying to him, not, you know, this is horrible. You got to wrap this. Like, we're done here. But saying to him, you need to, you know, do a couple things so that we can help you get more time.
Right, exactly.
To prosecute this war. And that's been said a few times. So those sorts of things indicate to me that they all are more in on the Kabuki theater and the, like, feigned outrage is, in fact, feigned outrage, not genuine outrage. And they are, you know, just accepting that, oh, Schumer's got to say that and Biden's got to say that or whatever to cover their asses from a PR perspective. You also, one of the thing, you know, that I would point to is one of the items that was put out there of like, oh, the Democrats really care about humanitarianism and Biden announced the temporary port to be constructed in 60 days or whatever. And this is announced as it's this great humanitarian gesture from the Biden administration. Well, lo and behold, the idea came from Bibi himself, and Bibi just said in a, like, internal committee meeting in Israel, you know, no one's stopping the Gazans from leaving. Maybe we can use that port for Gazans to be able to leave. It's like, oh, okay. All right, I see what we're doing here.
Yeah. And all the human rights organizations have condemned that as a total fig leaf, as ineffective. I mean,
well, you could just make them allow in the aid.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, there's trucks lined up. It's not that we don't have enough stuff or that there aren't enough possible points of entry. It's that Israel, with our not just like sitting back, but with our active support because we defunded UNRWA, starving people as a weapon of war.
So basically,
starvation is a weapon of war.
Nothing's real unless they cut off the money, cut off the weapons, condemn them at the UN. God forbid they ever were to do something like actually sanction the fucking war criminals, right? That never happened. But like nothing is real until it's like literally we're cutting this off. And the point we always make is even Ronald Reagan, he made the phone call when Israel was bombing Lebanon and said, this is a Holocaust. You got to wrap it up. 20 minutes later, they wrapped it up, right? George H.W. Bush, I'll give you $10 billion in loan guarantees only if you freeze settlements in the West Bank.
Yeah.
They froze settlements in the West Bank, right? Like, we're talking about these soulless Republican presidents with horrific, you know, careers.
Human rights records,
and they were able to reel him in. And I just, Biden just doesn't want to do it.
Exactly.
Like he always says, I'm a Zionist. You know, he always says it.
Yep.
I mean, I think Netanyahu missed a real PR moment when, you know, Biden was heard saying he wanted Netanyahu to have a come to Jesus moment. He should have said that was anti-Semitic.
I mean, I think he kind of implied
he kind of hinted it.
Said, like, well, I'm a Jew.
Because
so
he's like, I don't know what the president meant when he said that. It was one of those, it's like, shut up.
What do you make of Biden's positioning? Like, is it ideological?
He's a true believer. I think he's a true believer.
He's a true believer.
I do, yeah. I think he's has almost like a neoconish belief in this stuff. And he said, you know, if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent her. I think which again, I can't believe he says these things out loud, but I think he's a true believer. I mean, he's a politician. So ultimately I think that there's some pressure, right, that can be exerted, although I don't really see it working, except for in terms of optics. But I do think he's a true believer. I think I interviewed Rashid Khalidi on this, who thinks he has kind of casual contempt for Palestinians and the Arab world. And I do think he probably sees it that way. He obviously is okay with their deaths. You know, I think he's an overall pretty racist guy. He said things, he said something about Haiti once about how no one would care if it like crumbled into the sea.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I think he's a pretty racist dude. He's a bad dude, like Corn Pop, a racist dude. And I think he's a true believer. And I think he also feels like, you know, of course, there is a very big Israel lobby. Like the Democrats have to deal with AIPAC and the Republicans have to deal with AIPAC and CUFI, Christians United for Israel. And also other, you know, just the evangelical voting bloc. But I think that he actually is someone who believes that Israel is a, you know, he thinks they're going over the top, but he believes in their mission. And he apparently believes that, you know, he can't keep me safe. Joe Biden can't keep me safe. Israel keeps me safe. I mean, he said that twice, which I was like, can't people just tell him not to say that? Like, does he think that inspires confidence in Jews? Yeah, he does believe it. And of course, look, Jews can't have, we're not safe if we have to go to a country to be safe. That's a problem. The point is we have to be safe where we are. And I feel safer in the United States than I would feel in Israel.
Yeah, and arming and backing a genocide sort of definitionally makes you less safe because you're inviting backlash and blowback and all sorts. And they don't see that or care about that, which is insane. Yeah. Did you see, Katie, Jared Kushner's comments?
Oh, my God.
He was talking at some college thing, and he basically was like salivating over the, quote, valuable waterfront property, and he was talking about cleaning up Gaza.
Talking about anti-Semitic tropes. I mean, I'm so embarrassed that this guy is talking about real estate. I guess the good thing is that we have Trump, who's not Jewish, who's a real estate mogul. That helps us challenge the stereotype. But no, I mean, it's just disgusting. This guy, he's like a sociopath. He looks like he's made of wax, first of all. I'm always afraid he's going to melt or excited he's going to melt. But yeah, he was just basically saying that this could be a real estate investment. He was saying that like Gaza has no historical precedent. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Yeah, the fact that it's jam-packed with people is, or used to be before this, is because they were refugees. So because of Israel's wars and attacks and ethnic cleansing that made Gaza much more populated than it was before. But yeah, he's a, you know, and this is a guy who has the ear of his father-in-law, obviously. But yeah, he has real estate plans for there. The way he talked about it was just so cavalier. I mean, he couldn't have cared less about the people being slaughtered. It probably makes him happy.
And this is the guy with the $2 billion from Saudi Arabia, too. And my suspicion is I sort of vaguely remember covering an article about Jared Kushner's financial ties to Israeli banks as well. So not only did he sell out to Saudi Arabia, there's also Israeli interests he sold
out.
Bibi
like slept in his childhood bedroom when he was visit New Jersey. Yeah. So I mean the ties here are insane.
My God, I wonder what like if he read him books to sleep, like what it would be, what it would have been.
God, can only imagine. Yeah. I can only imagine.
Good night, Moon.
That also relates to now it looks like Steven Mnuchin, who has his own both Saudi and Israeli ties, wanting to potentially buy TikTok as part of this whole anti-TikTok freakout.
Israel has a TikTok problem, as Jonathan Greenblatt said, in leaked audio and then on real public audio.
I mean, it really is incredible because obviously there had been this banned TikTok discussion before, but it was pretty much dead. And then October 7th happens, and then, you know, you get that leaked audio from Jonathan Greenblatt, and you get Nikki Haley saying her insane, like, every 30 minutes you spend on TikTok, you become 17% more anti-Semitic.
Right.
Whatever insane.
How would you even crunch those numbers? How would that work? Like,
you are now 17% more anti-Semitic.
What, do you take a survey? How anti-Semitic are you afterwards? Like, what the fuck is this?
And now, lo and behold, TikTok may get banned with massive bipartisan support, and Joe Biden says he's for it. And he'd sign the bill as well. Like, it is incredibly wild. And it's also insane that they genuinely believe that this is like a TikTok problem, not a you're committing a genocide and we can see you and we're horrified problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's just these are young people who haven't been indoctrinated by corporate media problem.
Right.
And this is what everyone sees.
And they're still pretending it's about China, too, at this point. And it's just objectively not about China anymore. Like, it is 100% about the proliferation. I mean, there's been, you know, quantitative studies now about, like, how prolific the Palestine hashtags are versus the Israel hashtags, and they're terrified because the Palestine ones are way bigger and way more popular. And I mean, like you said, Jonathan Greenblatt said it on a news show, like, yeah, we have to address the TikTok problem, you know, and they misconstrue it and lie about it and say, because this is pro-Hamas stuff. How many times? I mean, I just covered a video the other day of Ben Shapiro. He was chastising Biden for, oh, you criticize the neo-Nazis at Charlottesville, but you don't criticize the hundreds of thousands of pro-Hamas people who are marching in the streets. It's like, you fucking asshole. They're not pro-Hamas people. That's the whole point. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
They're actually calling for the killing to stop. They don't want people to be killed, unlike Charlottesville people.
So, Katie, to sort of wrap things up here, I mean, how do you think that this, like, how does this end? What are we looking at here?
I don't know.
Do you think the political pressure can work? Are you hopeful about some sort of resolution, you know, before everyone is killed and starved to death? Like, where do you think this goes?
I don't even know. It's so horrible that to like look at that question, because I think the answer is not a very inspiring one, but at the same time, we can't stop what we're doing. Like, at the very least, we need to be raising our voices so that people know it's wrong. And who knows what teeny effect it has. I mean, it's so terrible, but maybe it saves some lives. Maybe it stops one, like, bombing from happening. Maybe it stops one shipment of weapons from happening. But we can't not do it. We can't get discouraged by, I mean, maybe we have to be smarter and more targeted, and maybe we have to target weapons and transport, ammunition transport, because I don't think that they're listening to us. I think that it's changing the Overton window is changing, which is important. I mean, you always have to have, thing is, you do have to lay this groundwork. Like, the Overton window has to change. What's morally acceptable has to change for there to be changes on the ground.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that there's so many people standing in solidarity. I'm glad that there are places like Jewish Voice for Peace that are doing work, and if not now, that are showing the world that not all Jews support this, that Jews see this as something that's, you know, not in our name, that never again means now.
50% of American Jews want a ceasefire.
Yeah, which is really important, I think. And so that's all encouraging. But, you know, every day, if you read the news, it's like, I mean, kids getting amputations, kids and adults, but it's especially painful to think about kids getting amputations without anesthesia. I mean, there's not anyone, no one can defend what Israel is doing and think that they are on this. I mean, I guess they can. They're like delusional, and their trauma and their fear is debilitating their consciousness and their empathy, and they are absolute monsters. I mean, people who support what Israel is doing are monsters. There's really no other way to put it. And no matter how hard people try, history will judge them as being on the side of killers. And people will look back and say, where were you during this period? What were you doing? What were you saying? And people are going to have to, you know, there's a scene, I don't want to give it away, but people are going to have to wrestle with this. There's a scene in Zone of Interest where the character has a physical reaction, and it's kind of cross-cut with modern day an Auschwitz Memorial Museum. And, you know, people are going to have to deal with that. It's not enough. I wish that they would suffer more, honestly, but they'll at least have to deal with the legacy, and people will look back in horror at this moment.
Yeah. The thing that maybe gets me more than anything is the starvation. Like,
oh yeah, we didn't even get into that. Right.
Thinking about
starvation. Yeah. Not just dying in a bombing, but actually dying of hunger.
Slowly dying over time of malnutrition, and their bodies wasted, and their parents unable to do anything about it, and the whole world and our country, like I said before, not just watching, but actually assisting in the starving of an entire people that I just will never be over.
And you have these ghouls who are like, oh, look how the father doesn't look like he's wasting away. Like, just ignorant people who don't understand how biology and nutrition work.
that's, yeah, I mean, that's all they have left is just denial.
That's right.
It's like, that's not actually happening. And it's like, well, here's 14 reports from various human rights organizations and the UN, and they all say it's happening. And now we have the names of some specific people who have died, and that's being reported. Right. And you can see the pictures of the emaciated fucking people. And they just go back to, no, that's just not happening. And it's like, well, how the fuck am I supposed to engage with you?
Yeah,
you're just going to ignore objective reality.
That's what he said in that debate. Yeah. It was like, they're always on the verge. There's no report that any of them starved to death. It's like,
I mean,
there literally are.
It's also like, okay, which is it? Israel is lying, or every single human rights organization and health organization and the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, are all lying?
And Cindy McCain.
Yeah,
you know?
Cindy McCain. Yeah, big anti-Zionist. Big, you know, you always see her rocking her keffiyeh.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There are no words to describe.
No, that's
what's
important because we don't see that the same way we see the bombings, right? We see the bombings, we see the amputations, we see the kids without limbs. I mean, it's heartbreaking and infuriating and awful. But we've seen some images of starvation, but most of the people who are starving, you don't have like a camera on them all the time to see them wasting away. And we will see more and more of these corpses. But yeah, that is something that is not being reported. And the idea of being a parent and not being able to get your child food, I can't even imagine. Like, it's just so unnecessary.
I can't either. Yeah, that's exactly right. Katie, tell people where they can follow you and your work.
So yeah, please do subscribe and come on down to youtube.com/TheKatieHalperShow. I do a live stream there every Tuesday at 7 p.m. EST, but I also release clips every day. Also, you can check out Useful Idiots on YouTube. We do a great thing on Monday mornings at 10 a.m. where we react to the Sunday morning news shows that we watch so that you don't have to. You can support my work and at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. And you get bonus content. You can also get bonus content at usefulidiots.podcast.com. And stand by. Oh, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at KT Helps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. Also, stand by for the release of my documentary, Commie Camp, which shows a very different Jewish tradition. It's a summer camp that I attended, that my mom went to, and my uncle went to, and my grandmother went to and worked at. And it was founded by Yiddish-speaking, secular, socialist Jews. And it is a camp where we actually commemorate the Holocaust, but we also, talk about the non-Jewish victims of the Holocaust. And we also commemorate Hiroshima Day because it's very much a camp that comes from this Jewish tradition of never again for anyone.
Mm. Well, we'll have to get Donald Trump to watch that and determine whether they, in fact, are Jewish or whether they hate their religion. So since he's the expert on that. Katie, great to see you as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Katie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right, so that was Katie Halper there. That was a very enlightening conversation. One of the things that I was going to bring up, which I didn't bring up early on in the conversation, is when we were talking about anti-Semitism. It was either South Dakota or North Dakota.
South Dakota.
Yeah, released Christy this like legal definition of what counts as anti-Semitism.
Oh my God!
And one of the things was comparing what Israel is doing to the Nazis. They now say that's anti-Semitic. So now, that would mean by definition, even if they literally set up like gas chambers.
Like, no matter what they do.
That you can't,
Like, even if they're like, we are doing Hitler's playbook and here's our concept. No, that's anti-Semitic to even say that. Yeah, no, it's so ironic and not at all surprising, but all of these Republicans who have spent years running around talking about identity politics and whatever, out the frickin' window.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine if, you know, a similar document and legal definition of any other kind of racism or anti-trans bigotry or whatever was passed by California? I mean, they'd be losing their minds over it.
Talking about the crime rate of black people is racist by definition. That's the equivalent of this thing, right? Like, if there's a higher crime rate in this specific area, it's like, you're not allowed to mention that at all. Like, that's what it would be, right?
Even, we were talking about this the other day, even the Trump comments about like, oh, you have to love Israel to be, you know, Jewish, or you hate your religion or whatever. Like, the idea that a specific identity group needs their own countrywide safe space is very antithetical to the, you know, supposed anti-woke politics that they've been preaching now for a while. It's like the polar opposite of what they've pretended to believe now for a few years.
It's just, okay, so if you take that position, right, if you're like, yes to the ethnostate slash theocracy, then the logic is be consistent. So if somebody wants to create a black nationalist state, by all means, go ahead. Somebody wants to create a white nationalist state, go ahead. You want to do Christian state? You want to do Muslim state? You want to break off into smaller and smaller sectarian little factions and create your own state? Like, if you're going to say yes to that, just say yes to it across the board, right? Or the other position is secular democracy is preferable. We like societies that are a melting pot and have all kinds of different people in terms of skin tone, religion, background, ethnicity, et cetera.
Yeah,
right?
Where your citizenship isn't dependent on immutable identity characteristics.
But for so many, this is the one where they're like, I support this one. And it's like, when you make, when the rebuttal is, okay, but black people went through slavery and Jim Crow, and like, not trying to do the oppression Olympics here, but if you want to try to objectively measure the level of oppression against a particular community, Jews had it really, really, really rough. There will be other in the same category that had a really, really, really rough over the years. I mean, just off the top of my head, like the, remember in Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims that they're doing a genocide against, right? Look at how Yemenis have had it with what Saudi Arabia is doing to them. Like, we could do this all day. And like, okay, how do you want to react to that? Do you want to say, yes, you get your own little exclusive club where now you in turn can oppress other people, right? And they just don't grapple with this basic question.
No.
You know, you can't, like, Sam Harris, for example, Mr., you know, enlightened liberal believer in secular democracy. But when it comes to the question of Israel, it's mind off. I support Zionism, an official Jewish state, because of the historical oppression against them.
Yeah.
Right? They need that safe home. And it's like, well, I don't, like, I literally cannot take you seriously if you don't also say Malcolm X was 100% right. They should have been able to get a black state.
Yeah, and that's why I bring up black nationalism, because it's a concept people are familiar with and have an understanding of, like, the problems with it. And where, of course, on the right, there's an instant reaction. Oh, of course, we can't have that. You know?
Right.
And it's like, well, you ideologically are supporting exactly the same thing.
That's exactly
it's just
right.
for a different, you know, group that was horrifically victimized. And even liberals also have, you know, a very negative backlash reaction to black nationalism. So when you put it in those ideological terms, I think it becomes very difficult to grapple with, like, well, why do you support it in this one case? And then it just goes back to, like, well, the Holocaust.
Okay, well, how many hundreds of years of slavery?
Which is,
right?
But, like, and that's exactly what...
Are we going to brush that aside?
And that's exactly what Jonathan Glazer was objecting to in his speech, is like, you can't just say, but Hamas and but the... He didn't say the Hamas part, but and but the Holocaust to justify literally any atrocity afterwards. There isn't only one group of potential victims in the entire world who then are just, you know, given license to do whatever to this now horribly oppressed and victimized group of people as well. So
every group of oppressors is convinced they're the victims.
They are the ultimate
victims.
That's
how you become an oppressor. That's the history. I mean, look, even the freaking Nazis, they were like, the Treaty of Versailles absolutely fucked us. The Treaty of Versailles ruined us as a country. We're in debt that we'll never be able to pay back. Nobody has any opportunities. We've been put upon. We can't deal with this anymore. It was out of the pain and suffering around that which led to the rise of Hitler.
Right.
So we, everybody can play this game of like, oh my God, look, you know, they're coming for me. I'm so oppressed. I'm so oppressed. I got to fight back and lash out and get them.
Yeah.
Like, that's the ultimate logic of it. Yeah.
And it's us versus them. And that's how you end up where we are. So Katie really made me want to watch Zone of Interest.
Yeah, me too.
Now, I've been wanting to watch it, but she made me want to watch it even more. So we got to check that out. We got to add that after we finish.
After we finish.
Quiet on set.
Quiet on set.
Then we'll pick up Zone of Interest.
Yeah, and then we got to go back to where we're rewatching The Sopranos, which is phenomenal.
Yes.
We just watched The Wire. Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going back, watch The Sopranos. Those are like the two that are consistently viewed as like one of the greatest
shows. Some of the greatest ever.
And they don't even have the downside of like Game of Thrones. Everybody doesn't like the ending, you know?
True.
Well, actually, The Sopranos they do, but it's literally like the last episode.
The last episode.
They don't like.
I didn't love the last season of The Wire. You know, it was not my favorite. I still enjoyed it though. It wasn't like Game of Thrones where by the end I'm just like disgusted, you know,
right.
with the whole thing. But I didn't love the plot line in the last season where they're like inventing this homeless serial killer situation keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Partly it just made me so, it gave me so much anxiety about how this is all going to come crashing down.
To me, I didn't like the season on the docks with the union workers as
That wasn't my favorite either.
Yeah, because I, you know, obviously your favorite is what's happening with the drug gangs and the police department.
Yeah, and those characters that are also incredible.
Yeah. So anyway, we're way off on a tangent here. But all right, guys, we love y'all. Everybody do us a favor. Please sign up, support the show. $5 a month gets you the video of every interview. It gets it to you a day early. You could also sign up for free on Substack, and then you can get the audio podcast emailed directly to you. Thank you so much for all the support. Remember, we never talk to any advertisers, so you guys help support us from the ground up. We will talk to y'all next week.